Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at BFL in Switzerland, and will be your host today. Today we'll be talking to Charles Foster about the new book, Being a Human, Adventures in 40,000 Years of Consciousness. What kind of creature is a human? If we don't know what we are, how can we know how to act? In Being a Human, Charles Foster sets out to understand what a human is, inhabiting the sensory worlds of humans at three pivotal moments in our history. Well, Charles, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Galina. Thank you.
So I would like to start by asking, how has this pandemic affected you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from this experience so far?
Well, I feel very embarrassed about saying it, knowing that so many people have had such a horrible time, but the pandemic has allowed me to get a lot more writing done than I otherwise have done. It's like, has been the case with so many people, slowed me down. It's made me watch the little things just around the corner, the local things which I normally zoom past. It's made me recalibrate. It's made me appreciate family, people, simple things. It's slowed down the fizzing busyness in my mind, and it's taught me quite a lot about human beings as well, which hasn't always been great, but I think I know a lot more about the sort of creature that I am and the sort of creature that my fellow human beings are.
So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
I'm an academic at the University of Oxford. I write for my living for most of the time. I am a veterinarian by background, a passionate naturalist. I grew up in Yorkshire in the north of England, right on the cusp of the neon lights of suburbia and the howling wilderness at the top of our road. The natural world has always been my passion, and I've been obsessed for ever really with the possibility of entering minds other than my own. So the brain of Charles Foster is a very echoingly lonely place, and I've wondered often how possible it is to understand what's going on inside anyone else's head. So that's been a motivating force through lots of my life in working out what I should write, what I should inquire into.
And along your journey, were there mentors that really supported you along the way?
I've had some enormously inspirational and sacrificial teachers. So there's a veterinary surgeon called John Cooper, wild about the wild, rather eccentric, collector of facts and artifacts, who persuaded me that there was a real virtue in being an old-fashioned naturalist, a generalist, who could make connections between lots of different domains. He taught me that it wasn't intellectually disreputable to be interested in lots of things rather than a tiny niche. Another veterinary surgeon, a deer farmer called John Fletcher in Scotland, again, has a rather piratical, swashbuckling approach to science, who sees it as an adventure in the way that it was originally seen in the Enlightenment. So these people and many others have given very generously of their time and their wisdom and their patience, and have seeded and fostered in me this this great thirst for relationship with the non-human world.
And you look into some of the really complex ideas and fields. Were you ever intimidated?
I'm intimidated constantly. Unless we're intimidated, we're not being ambitious enough, I think. Unless we're intimidated, we're not being humble enough. So, yes, this book, Being a Human, looks at the question, what is a human being? The most hubristic question to ask. Even angels don't know the answer to that question. Yes, at every step of this inquiry, I wonder, what on earth am I doing? How can I be arrogant enough to answer this question? How can I be arrogant enough to even to ask the question? But it does seem to me to be an important thing to ask. I'm a human being, and I want to know what sort of creature I am. And unless I have some idea what sort of animal I am, how can I behave properly? How can I learn how to thrive?
And what would you tell our younger listeners and early career researchers who might be a little bit unsure about tackling such big problems?
Well, I'm not sure that I have anything to teach anybody else. Many authors will tell you that their books are written for themselves, and that's true for me, I think, too. But tackling big problems, I would say that the maxim is, don't get it right, get it wrote. Get something down on paper, get something down on your computer without obsessing about whether it's elegant. I would say see writing as a job, just like anything else, rather than a romantic pursuit. So get to your desk at a specified time and don't get up from your desk until you've done a requisite number of words or got to the end of a particular section. And don't be afraid to ask the real questions. Don't think that the business of scholarship is just the business of adding footnote to footnote, which is very often how the academic project in particular is seen.
So your latest book is Being a Human, Adventures in 40,000 Years of Consciousness. Can you tell us how did you come to writing it?
I'm a human being. I didn't know what sort of a creature a human being was in order to work out how to be a decent friend, husband, father. I had to work out what a human being was. So that's the motivation behind this inquiry. And the way that I chose to do this was by going back in time. We can't know where we are or what we are unless and until we know where we've come from. So I went back and I tried imaginatively to inhabit three pivotal moments in the history of the evolution of human consciousness. The first of those was the Upper Paleolithic, about, say, 45, 50,000 years ago, when behaviorally modern consciousness, the sort of consciousness that we now have, is first seen in the archaeological record, when we were hunter-gatherers, wanderers, had a very intimate relationship with the natural world. The second period was the Neolithic. The times vary according to where you are in the world, but it's the time when we stopped wandering, when we became farmers, settlers, and our relationship with the natural world changed. And the third was jumping very much further forward in time to very close to our own period, so the Enlightenment. So the 18th century period, when it was thought that human reason could solve all problems, inquirers saw themselves as released from the restraints of medieval superstition, as they saw it, where there was a new spirit of inquiry. as we may come on to discuss. I think that that spirit of inquiry quickly became suffocated, producing some of the ills that we see in the modern world. But that was the method, and those were the moments that I tried to inhabit.
I found it a really unique way to look at human consciousness throughout ages. So can we start from the very basics? And can you tell us how do you define consciousness?
Well, it's a big debate, isn't it? But I would define consciousness as something like a sense of self, a sense of subjectivity. It's that which allows me to say, I am Charles Foster, you are Galina. We are different beings. It's the thing which allows us to have real relationships. I can't have a relationship with you unless I acknowledge the differences between us. And I can't acknowledge the differences between us unless I have a sense of what I am, and therefore a sense of what you're not. So it's the ability, to put it another way, to use personal pronouns in a coherent way. It's the ability to hover outside your own skull and look down at yourself and say, yeah, that's me.
So where in our history did you decide to begin?
So about 50,000 years ago. But in order to make sense of that story, we have to roll the film back rather further. So about 200,000 years ago, we see animals wandering the planet who are anatomically identical to us. They have brains the same size as ours, perhaps slightly larger, in fact, and bodies identical to ours. They appear to have the same neurological hardware and software as we have, but they don't act in the same way that we do. And then about 50,000 years ago, these bodies started to behave differently. They started to behave more or less as we do. They have the same sense of self, the same use of pronouns, insofar as we can construe that from the archaeological record, as we do. You see representations of the human form in the archaeological record for the first time, which shout out, this is me. So me, I. And if you have a me, if you have an I, and therefore a you, you can start to tell stories. In fact, you compulsively tell stories. So it's at that, the birth of pronouns, the birth of the I, the birth of stories which we would recognize, that I began the quest which is contained in this book.
So was this time tightly linked to the social aspect of our nature?
So the social aspect of our nature is something which is facilitated by this appreciation of ourself. Probably at the time of the early Upper Paleolithic, which is the time I'm talking about, we live for most of the year as small, wandering hunter-gatherer bands. There were probably larger clans, with whom language was shared, with whom some cultural characteristics were shared. But basically, the unit was the family and slightly larger conglomerations. We know from Robin Dunbar's work that we don't work well in communities more than about 150. 150 is Dunbar's number. We just don't have the processing power to deal with relationships functionally if we have bands more than about 150. And certainly in the Upper Paleolithic, we were in small functional units.
So was it predominantly the hunter-gatherer communities during this time?
Yes. Farming hadn't started then, or the management of land hadn't started on a wholesale scale at that point. So the pattern of life was one which required the people to be supreme naturalists, to know which berries would be on which bush at which season, to know when the caribou were going to sweep through the land, know when the hare was going to be there, know when the polar bear was going to appear over the hill. It required many more skills than hunt than farmers had. Farmers deal with a few species, and as we may come on to discuss, the business of farming means that you're dealing with species who are necessarily tamer, who are dumbed down versions of themselves. So yes, wandering hunter-gatherers with an intimate and sometimes clairvoyant connection with the natural world.
So what are some of the most notable developments in human consciousness from this time?
Well, the things that we see in the archaeological record are these representations of the human form. We see some of the best representative art that I think there has ever been, and that includes the wonders of the Italian Renaissance. So we see those glorious cave paintings, particularly in southern Europe, although I'm sure there's much more to be found in Africa. I'm sure the story happened much earlier in Africa than it did over here. But we also see an understanding that life doesn't end with physical death. We see religion. We see evidence of shamanic shuttling between worlds. We see an acknowledgement that the agency, which is there in everything in the world, including rocks, continues after the death of human individuals and probably after the death of animal individuals too, which makes feeding a very difficult thing to do. It's often been said that hunter-gatherers who believe that everything in the world is ensouled face a great liturgical problem whenever they want a meal, because having a meal involves killing something, de-souling something, and if you don't do it right, if you don't do it with the relevant respect, that thing might come back to haunt you. So there's a moral seriousness about the act of eating. There's a moral seriousness about the rituals which go with everything which life entails. You have to ask permission for the caribou to be killed. You have to say sorry to the caribou when you've killed it. You have to broker relationships with the creatures in the other worlds to which these souls have gone. There was an understanding that the visible world was not the only world that there is. And we now know that human neural networks are capable of processing 11 different dimensions. That's the four that we normally operate in, so three spatial dimensions, plus time and the rest. So we're wired up for much more than we normally recognize. And it seems that Upper Paleolithic people had techniques, maybe plant hallucinogen-induced or physiological stress-induced ways of getting to these other dimensions in which they believed that the dead resided. But their world was, although we characterize it as a simple one, a much more complex, multi-layered one than the one that we operate in, and required much more choreography in order to negotiate it.
It's truly fascinating, and I was really surprised when you pointed out that during this time, hunter-gatherers had time for leisure time. And this is something where they could sort of stop and slow down and reflect on what they have been doing.
Yeah. So all the evidence from modern hunter-gatherer communities suggests that being a hunter-gatherer is a much more leisurely occupation than being a farmer. If you're an efficient, informed hunter-gatherer, probably don't have to work for more than half daylight hours. If you're a farmer, you typically have to work for much longer hours than that. That's one of the many reasons why human communities have to be coerced either by climate change or oppressive overseers or whatever into the sedentary farming lifestyles, which we think are the way that all civilized people should exist. But because they had leisure and because they had this sense of self, all the evidence suggests that they began to tell great stories about themselves, stories which made sense of their place on the planet, their destiny after their deaths, the purpose for the whole created order. So some of the most fecund creation myths, those myths which have great explanatory power and great reassuring power, come from hunter-gatherer communities. The general trend of story, I think, is of simplification as we come nearer to the point where we are today. There's been a gradual dumbing down of the stories that we tell ourselves. So now, what is the story that we tell ourselves about what we are? That we are economically significant entities, Homo economicus, that the only good narrative or the only coherent narrative is the narrative of the free market, a pathetic, demeaning story, and no wonder we don't find it satisfying. The old stories are better. We've got to get back to them.
It sounds like Upper Paleolithic is the time of when imagination was born.
It was the time when imagination was born. It was the time when imagination flourished as it has rarely flourished ever since. I'm often accused of being rather romantic towards the hunter-gatherers who I've encountered. I don't think romantic is an indictment. I regard it as a high compliment. But certainly, I think it is true that there was a greater degree of thriving, even as we define it in our narrow way today, amongst those communities. They reflected, they loved, they saw themselves as operating on many levels rather than just the level of economic drudgery. They had relationships which were really meaningful with not only other human beings, but also with the whole of the created order. The animals and the plants were their friends. It was a much less lonely place than the world that we occupy now.
So as we move towards Neolithic age, what has changed?
At the Neolithic, we stopped moving. And when we stop moving, it's disastrous. If red blood cells stop going through your coronary arteries, you die. If water stops running through a river, it sludges up and gets stagnant and starts stinking. And that is more or less what happened to us. So we decided to trade the freedom of wandering the wide world. We decided to trade the freedom of living off thousands of species for the convenience of having a few tame species in the back garden. So we built walls across the land, which had previously been an entirely untrammeled place. And those walls ended up imprisoning us far more than they imprisoned the animals that we were trying to keep in a convenient place. We also built walls across our own minds. So we started to have the suffocating categories, the compartments across our own brains, which mean that we are now literally non-integrated people. So I'm sure we've all experienced it. We can live in one compartment for one moment and then live in another compartment of our minds in another without the two really communicating with one another. I think that's an artifact of what happened to us in the Neolithic. So what the archaeological record says is that we became farmers. And with farming came lots of things which are pretty dreadful. So we see epidemic disease for the first time in human populations as a result of the population explosion that grain allowed. We see the diseases of production. We see arthritic diseases in the women who sit there grinding the corn all day. We see the birth of really toxic status and hierarchy. In a hunter-gatherer community, it was fairly egalitarian. The women typically gathered the berries, and the men typically went out hunting, although those divisions were rather blurred. But the berries were more important. It wasn't possible for the men to think that they were the only or the main important providers. In farming communities, that's rather different. It's easy for men to get the delusion because they're out there in the fields doing the seeding and the harvesting, to think that they are the really important hunter-gatherers and the really important providers, and the women who do the work at home of grinding and homekeeping are less important. So you see divisions between the sexes of a really poisonous kind for the first time in that period. You see human-on-human violence on a big scale for the first time. That's because you have all your eggs in one basket, sometimes almost literally. So you have the possibility of harvests failing. In the hunter-gatherer world, if one area failed, you went on to another. If in a Neolithic farming community your harvest failed, you had to go across the valley and get corn at the end of a flint-tipped spear from your neighbours. You have war. So I said before that we typically see that people need to be pushed into farming from hunter-gatherer life. And this transition from hunter-gatherer life to farming life didn't happen quickly. It wasn't the revolution that it's in the past been represented as being. It happened very gradually and, so far as we can see, rather reluctantly, compelled by climate change, probably the cooling of the world at the time of the Lower Dryas.
So how did communities manage to pull themselves out of this stump development of the human consciousness, if I can put it this way?
It's a big question why free people chose to do this. Why they chose to be prisoners of their own minds, prisoners of their own self-built walls, to have minds which were constrained by concepts and by fences in a way that they hadn't previously been. And we don't know why that was, other than to say, as I've just said, climate change forced it on them. But I think that there is something going on here which is endemic to the human condition, and that is that we're not really as fundamentally attached to freedom as we like to think. I think we've seen that over COVID. We are fearful people who will trade a bit of, trade a lot of freedom for a little bit of security. We have this ontological insecurity, which means that we are attached to our backyards, we're attached to our artificial certainties in a way which is rather demeaning. And I suspect that was part of the psychological agenda for the change in the way of being that happened at the time of the Neolithic non-revolution.
So do you think that perhaps not having the luxury of free time as much during this time before the development of agricultural, things or technologies would not allow people to reflect as much as they should have on what was going on?
I'm sure that's part of it. But another part of it is that once you stop being a hunter-gatherer, you very quickly lose the skills which allow you to be a hunter-gatherer. You forget the knowledge of where the herds are going to be. You forget the knowledge of how to spear an animal. Within a generation or two, those skills are lost, never to come back. Also, if you become a farmer, you very quickly get tied into the tyranny of supply and demand. The harvest, which you think is yours, actually becomes your master. The profit motive becomes a big driving force and prevents you from leaving your village in the way that you had previously been free to do. And we see that all the time now in modern industrial countries, don't we? How free are we? We're tied down to our mortgages. We're tied down to our modes of production. We work more and more for less and less. We describe ourselves as more dissatisfied than we have ever been. Mechanization, which is supposed to free people, in fact, doesn't have that effect at all. Our hours get longer and longer rather than shorter and shorter, contrary to everything that the great prophets of the digital revolution had said was going to be the case. And I think we see something similar to that, the very birth of farming.
So how do we find ourselves progressing into the Enlightenment ages?
Well, it's interesting you use the word progressing. So before we leave the Neolithic, it's worth pointing out that perhaps the most corrosive development of the Neolithic was this notion of progress. It's unknown in hunter-gatherer communities. There, the pattern of things is circular. The cycle of the seasons, the cycle of the sun, the cycle of life and death, essentially a circular way of perceiving the way the universe is. When it comes to farming, the harvest, because of this tyranny of supply and demand, has to get bigger every year. And you would describe as progress a bigger harvest this year than last. And you see it in buildings as well. You see in the Neolithic times, the birth of rectilinear buildings, as opposed to the circular dwellings, which there are in previous ages. Rectilinear buildings are things which you can add to very easily, which stick their elbows into the wide, wild world. You can add a room here, add a room there, in a way which is very difficult to do with a circular building. Anyway, so you have this idea of progress, the idea that time is moving in a particular direction and that we are carried along in its flow. I think that the whole notion of linear time was unknown to hunter-gatherers. And time, as well as profit, became tyrannous. Anyway, so to pick up your word, we, in inverted commas, progressed towards the Enlightenment. I could well be criticized for choosing to pick the ages that I did pick. There'd be a case for saying that I should have paused at the time of the Axial Age, say between 5 and 7 centuries BC, when lots of the world religions were born, when there were lots of philosophical discoveries in places like Greece and the Middle East and China and India. I didn't do that because it seemed to me that there wasn't anything really tectonic about that time. What was happening was that there were different iterations of ideas which had been forged earlier. But anyway, I jump then to the scientific revolution of the 16th and 17th centuries and to the Enlightenment of the 18th. And the background to that was that there had been a perception that humans weren't as free to think as they should have been. They had been prevented from great flights of intellectual adventure by these superstitions of the medieval church. And so the Enlightenment said, there is nothing that cannot be thought. There is nothing that should not be thought. It was a time of great skepticism, of great intellectual excitement. But sadly, I think it quickly fossilized into the notion that there were some things that you could believe and some things that you couldn't believe. A catechism, really, but a scientistic rather than a scientific catechism. Catechism very similar to the catechisms of the medieval church, against which the Enlightenment was supposed to have been a reaction. But you get another really important thing happening at that time, and that was the desoulment of the world. Up until that point, in hunter-gatherer communities, in Neolithic communities, and even in the Abrahamic religions, there had been this idea that everything in the world had a soul. There were human souls, according to Aristotle, and vegetable souls, and animal souls. But everything had a soul. The Enlightenment said, no souls. There is only matter. And that was a catastrophic move, I think. It was catastrophic for lots of reasons. But one is the obvious environmental impact of it. Because if you conceive everything as a machine, which was how the Enlightenment saw it, a machine without a soul, there's nothing obviously wrong in destroying a machine. There is something rather obviously wrong in destroying something which has a soul. So all the environmental destruction that we now see, I think, would have been ethically impossible if the Enlightenment hadn't asserted that there is only matter. And it was demeaning to us as well, because if animals didn't have souls, eventually it was concluded that since we were animals, we didn't have souls either. We were only matter. And if we are only matter, then do we really have dignity? Are we really morally significant creatures? Lots of ills flow from the desoulment of the world and the idea that there is only matter, material reductionism.
This is really interesting. And it sounds like during Neolithic, we tried to tame and simplify nature. And during Enlightenment, at least in the beginning, people tried to tame their thoughts of people.
Yeah, I think that puts it well.
So you also write that skepticism and empiricism can and must help us recover enchantment. So that's really interesting. Can you expand a little bit more on this?
Yeah. So lots of my friends here at the University of Oxford are scientists. And they see the scientific project as something very different from the unfettered, adventurous business that it was conceived as being at the very start of the Enlightenment. They have received certain paradigms laid down by the Enlightenment fundamentalists, and they see the business of their day job as trying to squeeze the facts into those paradigms. That's a really boring process. There are lots of things which it is thought entirely contrary to the original Enlightenment ethos and cannot be thought. So it cannot be thought, for example, that matter might have a soul. The high priest of modern Enlightenment culture, Steven Pinker, says something like, one of the great achievements of the scientific revolution was to lay to rest the delusion that the universe is saturated with purpose. Okay. Now, regardless of whether or not we think the universe is saturated with purpose, one cannot demonstrate in a scientific way in a laboratory that the universe is not saturated with purpose. It is one of his fundamentalist axioms that the universe is purposeless, that matter is all that there is, that nothing has any intrinsic significance. So what I'm objecting to in the sentence that you quoted was this sclerosing of the idea of what science should be and what science should inquire into. People are terrified of asking really fundamental questions about the natural world because they will not get tenure at their universities, or they'll be mocked as scientific heretics. We've got something in modern science, particularly in modern biology, which is very like the medieval church's persecution of its scientific so-called heretics. It's different in the world of quantum physics. There you do see imagination allowed to flow freely. The scientific project should engage intuition and reason and imagination. Most of our great scientific discoveries have not been the product just of reason. They've been the product of a eureka moment, an aha moment. So typically in mathematics, people get the answer in a flash of inspiration and then spend their professional life in their university trying to prove the answer that they know intuitively to be the case. That's the sort of exciting business which scientific discovery of all types should be. So I would love a return to the original Enlightenment idea that there are no questions that can't be asked. There are no inquiries which are illegitimate. But I don't see that in the modern biological academy particularly.
So where would you like us to go from here?
I would like us in the scientific academy to say no holds barred and to acknowledge the possibility, for example, that the ensoulment of an electron or the ensoulment of a badger is a rather more satisfactory explanation for some of the behavior that we see in the natural world than the material reductionist explanation. I would like to see an acknowledgement that human beings are intrinsic parts of the natural world, and for their own sanity, for their own health, for their own survival, don't we know that to be the case, need to broker those ancient relationships with non-humans. I think humans are very special parts of the natural world, but still they are parts of the natural world. And I would like to see us regarding ourselves as creatures who are worth better stories than the stories that we usually tell about ourselves. What is the modern crisis? More than anything else, it's a crisis of story. We don't know where we're from, we don't know where we're going, and therefore we have no idea where we are. That makes us vertiginous, makes us constantly uncertain about how to act. So I do think we need to ask, what sort of a creature am I? And we can get some worthwhile insights into that by retracing the steps that we've taken along the human journey.
So in your book, we are meeting two characters. I was wondering whether we nowadays are able to empathize with people, for example, like them from Paleolithic or even Neolithic times.
We're the same. We have the same ways of mental processing, though some of our ways have been dulled by what's happened to us over many millennia, separating us from upper Paleolithic people. our capacity for empathy with anything, whether it's a squirrel or another human being, I think is much less than it was in those days. But those capacities for empathy can be and must urgently be renewed. And the process of trying to empathize with something as far away from me as an Upper Paleolithic hunter-gatherer, or as far away from me in terms of biology as a badger, are things which are worth doing precisely because there are difficulties. If I can work at empathizing with them, I will increase the bulk of my empathy muscles. So I'm probably going to be more empathetic to the Syrian refugee down my street, or more empathetic to my daughter when she asks for her phone back, or whatever it is. It's worth working at. And these sorts of thought experiments, anthropological method acting experiments that I've engaged in this book can maybe help us to do that.
So now thinking about the bigger picture, what would be the key implications of exploring these questions for our society?
Well, we can't know what we are unless we know where we've come from. That's the main one. And unless we know what we are, we can't know how to behave. We can't know how to behave towards ourselves. We can't know how to behave towards the non-human world. Unless we know what sort of animals we are, we can't have functional politics. We can't have functioning societies. So we are ruled by this sort of self-serving sociopaths who wouldn't survive for a moment in a hunter-gatherer community. By looking at hunter-gatherer communities, we can expose more clearly, in a way which obviously needs to happen, the inadequacies of our present political and social leadership. And we can learn how to be better friends and less unsatisfactory fathers.
Do you think this also would help us to be able to be kinder to our future selves or our children when it comes, for example, to climate change, where it's so difficult to imagine human society 100 years from now?
Yeah. Well, kindness is such an important word here. What I discovered in this book was that kindness is the most fundamental human characteristic. It's a characteristic which we can learn from the wild kindness of the non-human world, and which is generated by all relationships between people who know what sort of creatures they are and where they come from and where they're going. One of the things about hunter-gatherer communities is that they have this idea that the agency of the dead increases. They've got this idea that the people who aren't there as live creatures amongst them are nonetheless enormously important. And that would imply that future persons are enormously important. We have no regard most of the time to future persons in our politics or our decision making. That would be regarded as appalling for hunter gatherers. The way in which we treat the non-human world, which of course has a direct impact on those future persons, would be regarded by hunter-gatherers as frankly psychopathic. So we can learn lots of lessons from this look back at our past on the sort of creatures we are, the sort of creatures we need to be in order to survive. And we need to be kind creatures with a view to our children and our grandchildren rather than just our bank balances.
So how close do you think you came to figuring out what it means to be a human?
Well, it would be absurd for me to say that I know what a human being is. But this inquiry taught me some things about what the lowest common denominators of being a human are, about what some of the quintessential characteristics are. And they taught me about what makes me happy. and what makes me miserable. So how close did I come to answering that question, that biblical question, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Well, not very close. But I think even a little bit of progress, which is all the progress that I made, is worthwhile. And I'd encourage anybody to have the temerity to ask that question and to try to answer it in whatever way they can. Because we only get one chance per person to decide what we are. And the question, what are you, is a really urgent one, which affects not just you and your own happiness, but the happiness of everyone around you and ultimately the destiny of the planet. So it's hard to imagine a more urgent and important inquiry.
Would you be tempted to ask the question next of what's it like to be a bat?
Well, this is Thomas Nagel's great question, and I think it's often misquoted. It's a question which is supposed to point up the nature of consciousness. Is it like anything to be a bat? It was his question in relation to the question, is a bat conscious? In a previous book, Being a Beast, I try to inhabit the sensory worlds of various non-human creatures. That wasn't the same sort of inquiry as this one. I wasn't trying to find out what sort of creatures they were. I was trying to find out what it was like to look at a wood through a badger's nose, what it's like to inhabit an olfactory landscape, what it's like to take slices of time through your nose, sometimes millions of years at a time, when you sniff a London park and get odor molecules from carboniferous limestone, as well as from the rubber of the person who's walked over it a few minutes before. That again was an inquiry which helped me to flex my empathy muscles and made me a slightly, I hope, I'd ask my wife about this, a slightly less unsatisfactory husband and father. And I'd encourage anyone to do anything which gets them out of their own heads and into the heads of anything other than themselves, whether it's a badger or an embattled refugee.
So did you manage to recover the enchantment?
There were lots of moments when I sat in a wood, having divested myself of lots of the modern thoughts, this cognitive tinnitus, which is always hissing in our heads, when I was able, I think, to narrow the distance between me and the tree, between me and the deer, and to hear the voices of somebody other than myself, which was the purpose of this. And those voices are enchanting.
Well, this has been truly a thought-provoking discussion. So can you let us know what are you currently working on and what's next for you?
Well, thank you very much. I've very much enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for your very probing questions, which have forced me to look again at lots of my own conclusions. The next book out is a book called The Siege, which is a book of short stories about various mammals and birds and fish. And the idea of that book is that huge concepts like climate change or mass extinction are just too big for us to get our heads around. And therefore, we don't relate to them viscerally, emotionally, in the way that's necessary for us to make the changes which are so desperately needed. So in order to feel the things which we should be feeling about climate change, We shouldn't bombard ourselves all the time with the horrifying statistics. We've got to see how climate change affects the eel around the corner or the fox trotting up and down the street outside. So this is a series of stories which try to make things little, local, accessible, because we are little, local, accessible people ourselves. So that's the current project.
And what would be the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your books?
Well, the book is published in the UK by Profile Books and by Metropolitan Books in the US. There are a number of foreign language translations either pending or out. So there's one out already in Dutch, and a number of other translations will be out very shortly. There's a website, www.charlesfoster.co.uk, and that has a list of all my publications and links to blogs and so on, where I sound off about these and other matters, if anyone's really interested in hearing still more of what Charles Foster has to say, which I doubt.
Oh boy, I'm sure they will. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
I very much enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.